Welcome to Inflection Point, interviews with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, we investigate journalism, specifically radio, and how to get to the heart of the story.
I didn't start the interview by, you know, citing a bunch of documents and firing questions at him. I started by asking about his grandmother.
Investigating journalism. That's our inflection point. First, the good news. The number of women in radio news jumped 8% from 2012 to 2013. But the ratio of women to men across print, broadcast, and digital media is still only about 1 in 3, with men reporting twice as frequently on topics such as world politics, business and economics, and crime and justice, leaving the ladies to reach parity with men on reporting culture, lifestyle, and entertainment. Our guest, Laura Starczewski, helps make the split in public radio closer to 50-50. She's a reporter and producer for CIR, the Center for Investigative Reporting, and PRX's radio show, Reveal. For her most recent story, she worked with New Hampshire Public Radio to unveil 40 years of abuse and neglect of people with traumatic brain injuries at specialty rehab centers across the United States. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us more about the story you've been working on for this month's Reveal.
Yeah, this is a great story. It's about this kind of gray area niche in the healthcare system where really savvy business people have managed to make a lot of money and continue operating these places. They're accredited, they're licensed, and yet at the same time, they have these terrible records of abuse and neglect. And so the hour itself is trying to answer the story of how have they managed to persist all these years, and what is it about the backdrop system, our political system and legal system, that allows these people to continue operating these places.
So what kinds of things did you discover were happening inside their doors?
Yeah, there's a lot. The reporter in New Hampshire, Jack Rodolico, he was focusing on one place called Lakeview, and they have a pretty intensive record of bad things happening there, people being abused by staff members being hurt by clients, sexual assaults between clients, staff on client, client on staff. I visited a place in Florida called Finer that's a very similar facility. It's the Florida Institute for Neurologic Rehabilitation. And they had a staff person arrested in the middle of the night for abusing patients.
And when you went into this investigation, did you have a hypothesis about what you were going to find?
No. And I think part of the reason is that it's very technical, sort of, in terms of, well, what I was hoping to find was, you know, an explanation for what's going on here. Is it just that, you know, there are regulators and inspectors who are supposed to be keeping track of places like this and they're not doing it? Is it because they're private companies and it's easier for them to keep regulators out? That wasn't really true. In order to do the reporting, Jack and I had to dig into both the history of nursing homes in the U.S. because these places were kind of built up out of the nursing home business. Even though they're not nursing homes, they operate in terms of their business practices in a similar way. So we had to dig into this history of abuse and neglect at nursing homes starting in the 50s and going through into the 70s when there was a national scandal about it, and about fraud in nursing homes and how hard it is to hold the people running them accountable. And then what we found that's really fascinating is that just a handful of these nursing home operators found a way to reinvent themselves and open up these brain injury rehabs and still escape accountability over the past 20 years.
And who is sending patients into the rehab centers?
That's one of the kind of more painful parts of the story. The patients that end up in these for-profit brain injury rehabs, or sometimes they're called neurological rehabs, these are families who are really at the end of their rope. They're families that have kids, whether they're still children or they're grown, who have severe developmental disabilities, who have autism, and problems with aggressive and violent behavior. They're families who are trying to care for someone with a severe issue at home and can't anymore. And so they turn to places like Lakeview and Finer, the two facilities we really zoomed in on. And it's kind of a last resort for them. And a lot of this care is paid for with public money because states are required to provide education, for instance, for someone who has special needs or a disability. And a lot of times there just aren't facilities that can handle someone that has a problem with violent and aggressive behavior on top of whatever other disability they have. So they end up getting sent out of state. These places take people from all over the country. It's paid for by the states and federal government. It's public money that's sending these people there for care. And then when they get there, they're either not getting the care that was promised or worse.
And how much are people or the government paying for someone to be in one of these facilities?
At Lakeview in New Hampshire, the figure we got was that the average annual cost per patient was $292,000.
Per year.
Sometimes it can, per year, yeah. And sometimes it can go up higher than that, depending on the kind of care the person needs. That was just the average.
Not that it would be any less egregious if they were paying less money, but that's an astounding figure.
I know. It's really amazing. And they sell themselves as providing all of these intensive services because the people that go there need medical care, psychiatric care, behavioral therapy, physical therapy, schooling. They need a lot. And so that's why they're billing at these really high rates.
So when you go as a reporter, when you go in to investigate a story like this, and this is clearly not your first investigation, you're a seasoned reporter, how do you get the folks that you're investigating to answer questions for you that will help you fill out the story? How do you get them to be honest with you, I guess, is the question.
Well, it's a good question. I mean, sometimes they just won't talk to you. In this case, I did get lucky because the owner and operator of the Florida facility, this guy named Joe Brennick, he did want to talk. I think a lot of times it just depends on your timing. Finer, his facility, has come out of a bankruptcy in the past couple years. Their beds right now are half empty, so they're only at half capacity. And I think he wants to build the business back up and was looking for an opportunity to show that they are a good, solid facility. And I think that was the reason I got in the door, although I was surprised that he talked to me.
And we'll have to listen to the report to hear what he said. But, you know, when someone is responding to your questions, how do you know that they are telling you the truth? Or do you go out later and then check their facts? Just give us a little bit of insight into how an investigative report is done in a way that, yeah, you know, when it goes to air, you feel good about what you're presenting.
Well, you know, I try to get as many documents as I can that are primary source documents that I can look at and kind of have some numbers or just the documents themselves available to cite, because I think that helps people not feel like they can wiggle out of whatever question you're trying to ask. If you can say, I looked at the lawsuit, this is what it said, that helps. And then I think, you know, there's a lot of fact-checking involved once we put our story together, just making sure that we can back everything up, every single fact in the story up. There was another thought I had about your earlier question about trying to get people to be honest with you, or even just trying to get them to speak with you. I think in that circumstance, my style really isn't like a gotcha style. I was interested in, you know, where it was required holding this guy's feet to the fire, but I'm also really interested in what he thinks he's doing and what his motivations and backstory are. So I didn't start the interview by, you know, citing a bunch of documents and firing questions at him. I started by asking about his grandmother and how their family started in the nursing home business. And we talked about that for a long time. We talked about his grandmother. We talked about his dad. We talked about how he got into the family business. And I wasn't just doing that to kind of warm him up. I really wanted to know, you know, how does he see his family's role in this business niche and in the world? How does he see his role? And I think because I was framing the interview that way, you know, by the time I got around to the documents and the grievances that people have, he was willing to continue going along and answering questions. I also think there was a little bit of luck there that he, you know, was willing to sit through it and talk to me for about an hour and a half.
Do you anticipate getting it, that he would get in touch with you after the report is live with any concerns about what you might have aired from your interview?
I mean, I guess it's possible, but, you know, our goal is that the fact-checking is so solid, there would be nothing in dispute that we would put on air. And he might be unhappy with the angle, but, you know, we talked about this too. He said to me repeatedly, I really hope you're going to put together a nice story. And, you know, all I could say is I just have to be fair and look at the facts. And that's how I'm going to put together the story.
Well, listening to you speak, it totally flies against the stereotype of the hard-nosed investigative reporter, you know, very aggressively going after the story. And I'm wondering if you have found in your career that your approach and you know, and the way that you speak and the way that, you know, your sincere interest in the people and the topics and so forth, is that something that you've just brought to it naturally? Have you had to cultivate that? I mean, how have you found your approach being refined over time?
I started out wanting to do non-narrated radio documentaries where the source would just speak for themselves. And there was one story that kind of changed my approach. That was a story I started on right when I started in radio and really didn't know what I was doing when I started it. I was interviewing patients at a state mental hospital out in Queens, New York. And I ended up meeting a guy that was an artist and an inpatient at this hospital and sticking with that story for almost 10 years. And over the course of doing that story, I think I started it kind of so in over my head that I really wanted to understand the context and understand, you know, psychiatric diagnoses and the categories and the history of places like that and medication. And so I ended up going back to school and doing a master's in American studies and looking at the history of psychiatry in the U.S. and schizophrenia. That was this guy's diagnosis. And that's kind of a long chunk of time. But over that time, I got much more interested in the context and the systems kind of operating in the background of the life story of someone like him. And what I like about being at Reveal is that it's kind of the perfect marriage of the two things that I love. You know, one is telling really powerful, personal, intimate stories, and the other one is being able to give this deep context and explanation of what are the systems that really shape our lives.
But you've also done some lighter stories, and I'd love to just hear a little bit about those. One piece on why people talk to themselves in the mirror. Is that right?
Yeah. This was,
why do they?
Well, I started off thinking of, like, you know, Stuart Smalley on Saturday Night Live, who looks in the mirror and gives himself like a motivational talk. I'm good enough. I'm smart enough.
Yeah.
And gosh darn it, people like me. Right. So that's like a self-help thing that pops up a lot, especially for women. You know, I just kind of started noticing that, like, YouTube videos and life coaches and, you know, therapists, there's a lot of chatter and kind of advice that especially women get to like look at yourself in the mirror and tell yourself you're beautiful, you're great, you're going to do wonderful at this thing you're trying to do. And I wanted to do a story that kind of that just looked at like why do people think that works? What's the deal? What's the deal there? And I ended up finding a psychologist who explained basically that it really changes our performance on tasks, whether we address ourselves in the first person or the third person. So for instance, like if I was a high school basketball player or something, and I am convinced I'm going to do horribly in a game, and I say something like, God, why are you like this? Why do you do this? You're just not going to be able to prevail. Then you'll actually do worse in the game than if you tell yourself, if you address yourself by your name or in the first person, like, Laura, you're going to do great today. If you talk to yourself that way, it does change the way you perform. And the theory that he has behind it is basically that when you address yourself with your name and say, Laura, you're going to do great, you're creating this emotional distance and allowing yourself to see you as other people see you. And you just get a little bit like gentler and more supportive and more compassionate. And that was the closest answer I could find to why do all kinds of clinicians recommend that you look at yourself in the mirror and say nice things.
Well, this is definitely, now I want to know why I talk to myself in the grocery store. That's maybe a different issue. Go get the milk. Don't forget the eggs. Tell us about the story you did in Zambia about the 15-year-old girls who needed to learn to negotiate like they went to Harvard.
Yeah. This is an amazing story. I worked with Gregory Warner. He's the East Africa correspondent for NPR on this story, and he found this story. It's basically about young teenage girls in Zambia, so they're 13 to 15, who are getting this training that's modeled after the same negotiation training that MBAs at Harvard Business School get. And it teaches them how to negotiate in their day-to-day lives for things like asking their parents to help them with school fees so they can stay in school, because so many girls in Zambia leave school before they get to high school, or helping them figure out how to negotiate with a boyfriend to ask for safer sex. And I have to tell you that I learned a lot from sitting in on this negotiation training about, you know, choosing the right moment if you're going to attempt to negotiate for something, thinking in the other person's shoes instead of immediately setting up like an oppositional situation, like ask them what their interests are first. It was very instructional. And this, our story focused on one 15-year-old named Madalitza Molando, who was about to go into 11th grade and wanted to be a doctor, was really smart and engaged with school, math and science especially. And we told the story of how she almost didn't make it into 10th grade because her family couldn't pay the school fees. But because of this negotiation training she'd had, she successfully went around and basically campaigned on her own behalf from family member to family member to raise the, I think it was $150 or something like that, that she needed in order to pay her school fees for 10th grade.
We could all use a little of that, I think.
Yeah.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
So looking at the big picture of women in journalism, I know you're on the board of AIR, which is an independent radio producer network. What are you seeing in terms of the number and roles of women in public radio, independent producers or employees of networks?
Well, one thing is that I think public radio does a little bit better than public TV and commercial radio in terms of how many women are on the air as opposed to men, and how many women are in leadership positions. It's not 50-50. It's like 54-46 men to women, something like that in terms of percentage. But it's kind of close to 50-50, so it's not terrible. And I guess it should be 51-49.
Because well, technically. It's still better than across all entertainment, which is something like 30, you know, it's 1 in 3 women to men. So not too shabby, I guess, when you look at it that way.
Yeah, that's bad. Oh, man. Yeah. So public radio is a little bit better. And I think there are like two strains of conversation in the world of public radio that have come out more strongly in the past few years. One is about women's voices being critiqued and basically listeners writing in and complaining because they're hearing a woman talk on the air, basically, is what it comes down to. And there's been a lot more awareness of that and women pushing back against that and trying to just band together a little more and not let those comments get to you or believe that they say anything about your reporting ability. And the other strain has been around women in podcasts. So podcasts had their huge boom this past year with Serial, and there are like podcasts right now are kind of like the way blogs were in the 90s. Like, you have to have a podcast no matter who you are. You just should probably start one and have one. So there's tons and tons of people who have podcasts. And before this big podcast boom happened, Julie Shapiro put out a question that was basically like, okay, there are right now sort of a handful of podcasts compared to what they could be. This was before everything kind of exploded and podcasts really caught on. And she just was noticing that a lot of the podcasts that were being pushed the most had men hosting. And she started a conversation around that. And I have to say that, I mean, this, and when I say she started a conversation, this was like a real life conversation that people were having. This was like a long Facebook thread. She wrote a piece on it for a website called transom.org that kind of showcases new work and tracks goings on in our public media world. And since that, there are so many more podcasts now in general, and there are so many more with women at the forefront. So that's something that I've noticed and that I love. So there's a lot more in general now than there was a couple years ago, and there are a lot more podcasts with women creating them and hosting them, and that's really encouraging and fun to listen to.
Well, Laura, what is the best advice about reporting that you've ever received?
There are two things that come to mind. One is if you're embarking on a story, you should know why you are the person who must do that story. Meaning, what is the burning question that you want to answer and only you really can answer? And if you're not really sure what the answer is, that might not be a story you want to pursue. So to me, that's really advice about following your curiosity and having faith in your curiosity. And the other piece of advice has more to do with interviewing, and it's just to not talk, to just ask a question and then be quiet and don't try to jump in and fill dead air. You have to let people process their thoughts and fill in the gaps themselves. And I'm kind of a quiet listener in the first place. So I loved when I learned that that was actually like a strategy and a technique that could help me because I love just sitting there and listening to someone talk for a long time. I think that's a big reason why I got into radio in the first place.
Well, thank you so much, Laura. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you for having me.
That was Laura Starcheski, a reporter and producer for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. A link to Laura's episode is on our website at inflectionpointradio.org. As part of this week's Inflection Point, Investigating Reporting, listen to our interview with Suzanne Reber, the co-creator and executive editor of Reveal.
Audio is something that we're hardwired for. We're hardwired for story. We're hardwired for me wanting to hear what you have to say.
That's our Inflection Point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, listen to previous shows and sign up for our email updates. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/inflectionpointradio. Follow us and follow me on Twitter at L.A. Schiller. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations nationwide through PRX. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.